Today at Reader's Corner, A.O. Press, author of Dirty Work, Essential Jobs and the Hidden Toll of Inequality in America. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. In Dirty Work, Essential Jobs and the Hidden Toll of Inequality in America, A.O. Press offers a paradigm-shifting view of the moral landscape of contemporary America through the stories of people who perform society's dirtiest jobs. As his book shows, we are increasingly shielded and distanced from an array of morally questionable activities that other, less privileged people perform in our name. This is the first half of our two-part interview. A.O. Press is a writer and journalist who contributes to The New Yorker, The New York Times, and other publications. His other books include Absolute Convictions and Beautiful Souls, and that was a great book. The winner of a number of honors and awards, including an Andrew Carnegie Fellowship, Press holds a Ph.D. in sociology from New York University. A.O. Press, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Well, this is really a treat for me because I so much enjoyed the book, and I guess treat is not exactly the word you'd use to describe a book like yours, but it's so informative, and your research was so impeccable. I've underlined about a dozen books in your footnotes that I've got to read, and it's going to take me a long time to get through all these. But as far as this book is concerned, what we're going to do here is deal with the first two or three sections of your book in this segment. And then next week, we're going to cover the rest of it. And let's begin generally with the subtitle of your book, Essential Jobs and the Hidden Toll of Inequality in America. It brings to mind, as you point out, the medical professionals who are struggling to keep COVID patients alive in our hospitals and who have been on TV and on radio regularly shown as these heroes. Let's begin by having you clarify your definition of the essential jobs you cover in your book.
Yeah, I mean, it was striking to me as I was actually finishing the book as the pandemic began, and I started opening the newspaper and turning on the nightly news and seeing these stories about, you know, medical responders, nurses, doctors on the front lines of the pandemic, often put in very, very difficult moral situations. You know, who gets the ICU when you've got just a crush of COVID patients entering the hospitals, as was true in New York City, where I live, but really true in much of the country for many months, and is actually happening again now.
That's right.
And that dilemma is a terrible one to think about having to be in. You know, what that does, and the physicians were often on the news or in the papers talking about it and being portrayed, I think for good reason, in a very sympathetic light. And again, they were also, again, in New York City, there were evening tributes paid to the medical workers who were going through this. People would stand on their stoops and lean out of their balconies and clap and bang pots and pans. But what struck me about it is that I'd been spending the last couple of years writing about and researching the lives and dilemmas of actually Americans who do very morally troubling jobs and are never applauded for, never get the kind of recognition, are not heard from on the nightly news, and are not really described very often in the newspapers. So it was really kind of a jarring experience. On the one hand, I thought, oh, this issue is finally coming to the fore. On the other hand, I thought, you know, there's a whole invisible class of workers out there who do jobs that keep this society running and are constantly put in these difficult ethical situations, and we don't hear from them and don't see them.
Now, the word dirty work, there are some components to that word that you use to define and report them. What are those? How should we look at this?
Yeah, so I think when people hear that expression, they probably think of, I don't know, garbage workers
right,
clearing the trash off the streets,
yeah,
or people just doing a kind of unpleasant, maybe physically dirty job. In my book, it's different. I take this term dirty work from the sociological literature. We can talk more about that later, but one particular sociologist, Everett Hughes, and I draw on his work to define dirty work as unethical activity that society depends on and tacitly condones, but doesn't want to hear too much about. And when I thought about sort of the components of this work, one piece of it is that it is work that does substantial social harm. That harm can be to other people. It can also be to the environment or to non-human animals, because I look at industrial slaughterhouses in quite a bit of detail. But it also harms the people who do it. That's a crucial second piece of it, so that it is putting not just, you know, other people in trying situations, but the workers themselves in these situations. And the third component that is very crucial to it is that it is work that has a kind of tacit mandate from society. In other words, we sort of know it's going on, but we don't ask too many questions about it, because at some level, it sort of serves our interests, and maybe we actually see it as necessary. You know, some people, as they hear this discussion, will say, well, it's not necessary, but I'll try to unpack that term and explain why I actually think it does apply.
So there are certain barriers that really prevent us from knowing and caring about those who do this work. But the one that caught my eye was the barriers of the mind that you point out. Help us
Absolutely.
With that.
Yeah, so I write about all of the forms of work, of dirty work that I write about, whether it's the dirty work that goes on behind the walls of jails and prisons, or the dirty work of conducting targeted assassinations in the drone wars. All of these forms of work are hidden from the public in certain ways, whether it's secrecy laws or physical barriers like gates and walls and so forth. But I actually think that the most important reason we don't talk more about this is not those barriers. It's the fact that in our own minds, we want to kind of change the subject. I mean, if you think about drones, and you know, we'll go into it in greater detail, but yes, it's a secret program. And the folks I interviewed who actually served in it did not talk about operational details. And yet you can go online and Google drones, you'll come up with 6 or 7 different books. You'll come up with probably some documentaries and maybe even some feature films. Likewise with the prison system. There's so much out there if we choose to see it. But I think that what we often don't do is have what you know I refer to as the will to know about these things. Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about prisons, and maybe we can begin by having you give us just a brief refresher on how our prisons wound up serving as mental health wards overseen by prison guards with little or no training in mental health.
Yeah, so I really hone in on that particular aspect of the prison system, that it has become, in effect, a de facto mental health system. Because in every state in the United States at this point, the largest mental health institutions are not public hospitals or community health centers. They are jails and prisons. And I look in detail in Florida, but Florida is really not unique. You could do this in just about any state. And to trace it back, it goes back to the deinstitutionalization movement, a movement that actually had very noble intentions, I think, where a lot of advocates on behalf of the mentally ill in the 70s and 80s and 90s felt, you know, the mental health asylums that existed were not treating people humanely. And there were exposés in the media. There was a lot of, you know, protest. Presidents dating back to John F. Kennedy, who was particularly important in this because of a family connection to someone who suffered from mental illness. There was this real moral push to say, we can do better for these people. They are our brothers and sisters, our cousins, our neighbors. But what happened, and what I show in the book, is that deinstitutionalization did lead to the shutting down of asylums, but it did not lead to the community mental health treatment centers that were envisioned. And so what we've ended up doing is relying on jails and prisons to effectively warehouse a very large population of people who really need treatment, not confinement in a correctional institution, which I think is the very last place that anyone with a loved one who suffers from mental illness would want to see that person.
You're listening to Ale Press. He is the author of Dirty Work, Essential Jobs and the Hidden Toll of Inequality in America. So tell us about Harriet Krzyzkowski and Darren Rainey as examples of how the dirty work gets more than just dirty.
Yeah, so Harriet Krzyzkowski is the first character in the book, and she ends up getting a job at the Dade Correctional Institution. It's a state prison in Florida, south of Miami. Harriet really didn't know what she was getting into. She took the job because she needed work. This was after the 2008 financial crash, and she had a family, two young children at the time. Her husband did not have a job. So she gets this job. She's paid $12 an hour, by the way. So it wasn't exactly, living large off the salary she earned. But it turns out that the most difficult thing about the job was not the low pay. It was the mistreatment and abuse that she witnessed. And, you know, it began with little things. She would notice that, you know, the guys in the mental health ward who she was supposed to take out to the rec yard for fresh air were not allowed out on Sundays, which they were supposed to be allowed out. It was their only kind of opportunity to, you know, see the sky and so forth. Then she started hearing prisoners complain that they weren't getting meals, that some of them were being punished by basically given empty food trays. And when she tries to report some of this to her supervisor, she immediately gets a lesson in why you shouldn't do that if you work as a mental health aide in a prison. Because the guards, who are, by the way, there to protect her, she's working in an all-male prison, and she's got to have her own safety while she's doing her work. They suddenly start disappearing from, say, group sessions that she's running. The guard by the door, who's normally there, she looks up and the guard is gone. Or they don't open the security doors for her in a timely way. So she's kind of left, you know, in a really vulnerable situation. And in fact, on one occasion, when there was no guard around, she was nearly assaulted in the rec yard of this prison. So she gets the message right away that you don't defy security. You keep your mouth shut if you see things that, you know, you think maybe are wrong. And unfortunately, the wrongs become extreme, because she arrives one day at work and hears that a prisoner named Darren Rainey, who you mentioned, was suffering from schizophrenia and was locked inside a shower and collapsed in that shower from the heat. And when Harriet first hears this, she thinks, well, did he have a heart attack? Did he just, you know, what exactly happened here? And the nurses tell her, no, he didn't have a heart attack. The guards rigged up that shower and controlled the flow of the water from the outside. And this was a punishment. And the water flow was 180 degrees through that hose, from what we know. That is the temperature of a cup of tea, just to give folks a perspective. Mm-hmm. And so Rainey was not someone who just, you know, collapsed on his own. He died and actually suffered burns across his body. And when Harriet learns of this, she's horrified. And as she said to me later, I felt someone has to report this. You know, this is just not right. But she wasn't going to report it because she needed her job. She needed to, you know, protect herself. And actually, none of the mental health staffers reported it. And I hone in on that not to condemn them, but to give people a sense of the dilemma that these folks are in. You know, on the one hand, they're supposed to be providing treatment. On another level, they're in an institution of confinement, and they are in need of, you know, basic things like safety themselves. And so Harriet starts to experience just tremendous emotional and psychic wounds, really, from staying silent about what she knows is wrong.
One of the things you point out in this section is the steady drift from a rehabilitation ideal in America's prisons to a more punitive approach. And I wonder if maybe you could comment on Judy Thompson's son as a perfect example of how our laws have become more punitive. I mean, when I read what happened to this guy, I'm thinking, we do that to people? I don't want to say that they weren't crimes, but if I'm not mistaken, they weren't crimes of violence. Am I right about that?
That's right. Yeah. So what happened, and it happened over decades, we've started to kind of, you know, have a correction to this in a sense, to rethink it. But what I trace in the book is that we did indeed have a correctional system that was really built on the idea that, you know, you're there to be rehabilitated. Eventually you will come back to society, and we hope you will come back chastened and ready to be a productive member of society. But of course, that's not going to happen if all you see when you're in prison is, you know, brutality and violence and a kind of us against them, and really a conditions that don't rehabilitate folks. As I say in the book, you know, in the 70s and 80s, we really adopted a new philosophy. And the new philosophy was essentially, you know, incarcerate to punish, to teach people a lesson. And Judy Thompson's son is one of the people who gets swept up in that. As you say, he was involved in a crime. It was a crime. It was not a violent crime. And yet he's given an incredibly long sentence, and effectively his whole life is upended. And Judy Thompson, an African-American woman from Florida, you know, isn't paying that close attention to all of this until it hits her family, it hits her own, you know, just in a tragic way. And then she starts getting involved in it. She becomes an advocate and tries to reform the system. And some reforms have taken place. But unfortunately, what she comes to learn and what others I interview in the book, you know, come to discover is that, you know, the correction has been minimal so far. The conditions in Florida's jails and prisons are dehumanizing, not just for the folks who are incarcerated, but also for the folks who work in this system, because it is increasingly, you know, overcrowded facilities with a pared down staff working longer and longer hours. And the way that order, to the extent it exists, is enforced in these places is through fear, through threats, through brutality.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to leave it to our readers to finish up on that section of prison guards, and we're going to move on and talk a little bit about what you call joystick warriors, otherwise known as drone operators. First of all, could you give us some idea, Ill, of the size of the drone operation? I must say that I was mystified when I saw those numbers. You just don't get the feel for that when you're watching a movie I saw a couple of years ago about a drone operator in a tough spot.
Well, I think that we don't get that sense in part because the popular perception, actually the terminology for drones, we hear the phrase unmanned aerial vehicles.
Yeah.
Right. And so you think, okay, it's unmanned. It's actually a machine. It's kind of a robot operating on its own. And it was actually one of the drone operators who expressed real bitterness about that term because, you know, as he put it to me, it's hypermanned. It's not unmanned. It's hypermanned. Mm-hmm. There is, you know, there are imagery analysts in the chain. There are sensor operators, and there are, you know, remote pilots and also commanders. So there's a whole network. We're talking about hundreds of people on the bases that I, you know, visited, yeah, both in Nevada and in other places. And this is the way we have, in a sense, continued the never-ending wars. You know, after the withdrawal from Iraq, and now more recently, the withdrawal from Afghanistan, that has come about because as a nation, you know, we felt this is too costly. You know, we don't want to go around the world nation building when we have our own needs to take care of and our own citizens to take care of. We also don't want to see our soldiers coming home with PTSD or with, you know, lifelong injuries or sometimes in coffins. And that's very understandable. But the drone program has actually been the solution in a way for a society that kind of started to tune out what in fact are ongoing wars. And I wanted to look into that and to see what happens to the people who actually are doing this remote warfare.
I'm Bob Custer, host of Reader's Corner. Today I'm speaking with A.O. Press, author of Dirty Work, Essential Jobs and the Hidden Toll of Inequality in America. The book offers a groundbreaking and urgent report from the front lines of dirty work, the work that society considers essential but morally compromised. One of the examples you use is the career of Heather Linenbaugh, however you pronounce that, and something that she witnessed. And about the time that I'm reading this in your book, there's the withdrawal from Afghanistan, and not long after that, the killing of innocents by a strike, a drone strike, by our military, and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff is out there apologizing that this never should have happened. And I'm thinking, this is exactly what Press is writing about in his book, and here it is happening all over again. You talk about moral injury. The fact, and again, let me emphasize, when I'm reading this, all I'm reading about is the people killed on the ground, which I should read about. You know, that was just historically unnecessary and should never have happened. But it did happen, and while we must feel remorse for those who were killed, there's not a word about who did it, how did it happen, what happens to those people who did it. Somebody was sitting outside of Las Vegas with one of these drones in their sights and made the wrong call or got the wrong call from the ground, whatever it was. And I'm leading up to what you call moral injury, where the suffering is not only about those who get killed on the ground, but I'll let you take it from there, those who are really doing the killing.
Yeah, so I think I want to acknowledge that, you know, there are people probably listening and certainly in society who would say, well, you know, this is necessary to protect this country and you know, which was attacked on 9/11. We just marked the 20th anniversary of that attack, and so on. You know, that's a legitimate point of view. I don't dismiss it. But what's striking to me about the drone program are two things. One, you just touched on, and it's the total lack of accountability for these strikes that do in fact, sometimes hit civilians who are not involved in terrorism, but also hover over, you know, people's lives on a daily basis. It's the lack of accountability, and it's the secrecy. It's the fact that as a society, we really don't talk about it. It's turned into a kind of background noise. In fact, I was writing this book and I began and then ended. There were two presidential elections. There were endless numbers of debates. I didn't hear one question at any of those debates, not in the Democratic primaries, not in the Republican primaries, just asking the candidates, hey, what about these drone wars? Should we be continuing this? Should we be, you know, should drones be hitting countries with which we're not formally at war? No conversation. And that to me is the problem. And so, you know, as a society, we're not seeing it. But as you noted, people like Heather Linenbaugh and Christopher Aaron, the two drone operators whose stories I tell, they do see it. They are in the middle of it all. And despite the stereotype that this is just like playing a video game, what I discovered, and this came as much from people inside the military as it did from my own observations, there is a phenomenon of moral injury that is going on. And moral injury refers to seeing and doing things that go against one's core values. And it's a term that certainly among veterans has really gained currency in the past decade or so, because it's a very different kind of wound than PTSD. PTSD is, generally speaking, the wound of, you know, we associate it with brain injuries that come from roadside bombs and near-death experiences, exposure to danger, and the kind of fear that triggers. And that's a very terrifying and very real thing. But moral injury is something different. It's a wound to the soul, and it's the sort of haunting of one's conscience when you look back and think, who did that drone strike, you know, hit? And for for Chris Aaron, one of the operators I you know, write about, you know, he started having thoughts about how a strike that had hit one target ended up resulting in multiple coffins in the streets and many, many funerals. So who were all those people? And again, you know, to see that is not at all like playing a video game. Indeed, in the drone program, you have high rates of burnout and a lot of difficulty of recruiting people to do it. And the reason is that it is very intense and very vivid and visceral for the people who are looking at the screens.
Well, one of the ways you show just how serious this moral injury is the way the military has assembled this staff of people to be there for these drone operators. Tell us about who they are, the people that are standing in wait to deal with these drone operators who have made these killing decisions.
Yeah, I was really struck by that. I went, you know, as I say, I went to Creech Air Force Base in Nevada. And, you know, maybe for people on the outside, they're thinking, oh, it's a lot of high-tech machinery and, you know, people playing foosball when they're not on their shifts and a kind of carefree atmosphere. And you know, I saw some foosball tables, but I also visited the place where the chaplains are there to talk to people in the program about the moral questions that they're grappling with, that folks are trying to deal with. I spoke with psychologists there. And, you know, what they told me, which was really striking, is, you know, these are not, given that the soldiers here are in remote combat, you're not seeing those, you know, brain injuries from roadside bombs. That's not the issue, really. So what is it? And what it is, one of them told me, is closer to moral injury. It's, you know, what is Jesus going to say about all the killing that I've seen, you know, and all the carnage that's on those screens? And by the way, it's decision making for those in this program that are life and death decisions on two levels. One is, you know, the soldiers on the ground. If a wrong decision is made, their lives may be at risk. And for Heather Linebaugh and some of the other people I talked to, that was haunting. But then there's also, you know, seeing footage of villagers, you know, after strikes occur, picking through the rubble and you know, trying to find out if anyone they knew was there. So it really is a form of, you know, a burden that has much more to do with, have I done something that goes against my own values, and not so much, you know, I lived through a near-death experience.
How does the peace group Code Pink show the contrast between the privilege to never have to serve and those who do serve?
Yeah, so at one point in, you know, I talk a lot about how we're not paying attention as a society to what's being done in our name over and over in the book. And then I also kind of draw attention to some people who are paying attention. And in the case of drones, there is this group, Code Pink, peace activists, women-led peace organization, and they have gone to the bases and they have, you know, protested and tried to really draw attention to this issue. And so, on one level, you know, I'm showing through them that you know, it's not true that everybody's ignoring this. They're drawing attention to it, but there is a tension that I write about in the book, and it's a tension felt by some of the people in the drone program because they, you know, pass the protesters and sometimes feel like the finger is being pointed at them. You know, why are you doing this? Why are you involved in these, you know, targeted killings? And the, at least one of them, Heather Linebaugh, whose story I tell in one of the chapters, you know, says to me, you know, those protesters had no idea what we were going through. they didn't think about how little we actually control in the drone program. And, you know, that's a, the tension there, I think, is not just, you know, hey, they don't know what it feels like to be in our shoes. It's also a class division. It's the fact in her perception, and I think in many people's perception, that, you know, the folks who end up in the military are by and large from less privileged and, you know, wealthy backgrounds than some of the protesters who appear to, you know, say, hey, this is wrong. And that class division has probably been there, you know, as far back as Vietnam, if not earlier in America. But it creates a tension. And I think that, you know, the sort of, you know, as much as one can say we should be paying attention to these wars and what's going on, I think that just pointing the blame or pinning the blame on the folks who are in the program, that's limited. Because after all, as a society, we have come to, you know, fight our wars this way because it's seen as a win-win for many of the politicians, for, you know, the more powerful decision makers and commanders. So that's kind of what I write about in that section.
Mm-hmm. And one drone operator, Francisco Cantu, actually decided to tell his own story in a book, did he?
Well, Cantu was actually not in the drone program. He was a border patrol agent.
Oh, that's right. That's the section of your book where you shift over to the drones that are being used to track what's going on at the border.
Yeah, but it's actually a really interesting story because, you know, this book comes out, a border patrol agent writes about it. And actually, you know, he uses the term moral injury in that book. He talks about how he joins the border patrol thinking he's going to be going after, you know, the big drug smugglers who are trying to, you know, cross the border and all the kind of, you know, criminal gangs and so forth. What he ends up meeting over and over again in the field are just very poor people, migrants, who have crossed the border because they're desperate. And it's his job to find them and to send them back and to apprehend them. And he's very good at this job, but it takes a toll on him because he starts to think about how actually his own family a couple generations earlier had crossed the border and how, after all, these migrants haven't done him any harm, and he starts to sympathize with them. But the reason I write about his story is that he publishes a book about this, and at some of the readings that he gives, people who oppose, basically migrant rights activists, start protesting and saying, you know, we should ban this book. We shouldn't read this book. We shouldn't have these readings because this person was in the Border Patrol. And therefore, by virtue of that, they have, you know, they're guilty. They have responsibility for some of this. And my point in the book is not that's wrong. You know, sure, he has some responsibility. My point is that so do the rest of us. You know, that the Border Patrol agents are carrying out state policy. And so, you know, the circle of responsibility extends far beyond them. And I think all too often, we don't end up seeing that, right? We just kind of are content to, you know, again, to go back to the case of the prison guards, when you see an abuse like the Darren Rainey story in the newspaper, oh, those terrible guards, what did they do? You know, those guys should be fired. They should be held accountable. Well, yes, they should be held accountable. But what about the warden? And what about the head of the Department of Corrections? What about the governor of Florida, who is responsible for the Department of Corrections? And in fact, the governor of Florida at the time of Rainey's death is now a senator, Senator Rick Scott. He was the governor then. He ran for Senate. He won. He wasn't held accountable. So, you know, we have to broaden the circle of responsibility, I think.
Well, AOL Press, we've run out of time, but I want to thank you for joining us today at Reader's Corner. The name of the book is Dirty Work, Essential Jobs and the Hidden Toll of Inequality in America. We really only got through half of it, so please join us next week as we continue our conversation with AOL Press. Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio News. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.